Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Bridget Stevens. She's a Steve Irwin protege who fell in love with an orphan wombat, sold her properties, left her family and friends, and moved 2,500 kilometers to establish the only free-range, cage-free wombat sanctuary. Bridget and her friend Claire are the only people in the world who live within a community of wombats and are at the forefront of wombat advocacy. So first, thank you for your work, and second, thank you for being on the program.
Thank you very much for having me.
So let's start by talking about who, what and who are wombats.
Okay, wombats, they're native to Australia, and they are short, round burrowing marsupials. They're the largest burrowing marsupial in the world. They are about a metre long and about a foot tall, and they are full of attitude. They live in large social groups, and their warrens are absolutely massive.
And how much do they weigh?
They can weigh up to about 32 kilos. But
so
we have had wombats in that are 55 kilos, so they range quite a bit.
So for people in the U.S., that's 80 to 120 pounds. So that's like the weight of a big dog.
Yes. And they're full of muscle.
And so how many species of wombat are there?
There are three species. There's the northern hairy nose, the southern hairy nose, and the bare-nosed wombat. The bare-nosed wombat stands alone by itself. It is very, very different compared to the hairy-nosed wombat. It lives in a much wetter environment. It's mainly solitary. It's nowhere near as social as the southern or the northern hairy-nosed wombat. And its breeding cycles, everything is completely different. Whereas the southern and the northern hairy nose, they're cousins. And they live in semi-arid to arid environments, really harsh environments here in Australia. And they live in large social groups. Their burrows are massive, and they're extremely intelligent animals.
And how massive is massive?
I have seen one warren that has taken up 500 acres. And that had over 289 entrances. And that would have to be the largest and one of the oldest warrens I think there are here in Australia.
And how many, I mean, they're underground, so we can't tell for sure, but how many individuals do you think live probably in that, how big again was that?
It was over 500 acres, 289 entrances.
So how many individuals, just take a guess, how many individuals lived in that community?
I would say 40.
40,
that's...
Oh, so they have like six entrances per person.
Well, sometimes they'll all use the one entrance. And there's no rhyme or reason. I don't know why, and I don't know if it'll ever work out why. They only use some holes, some entrances, and what my thoughts are is that, and what we've seen in our sanctuary, is that their job in nature is to infiltrate water into the water table. And so they'll have their main entrances, but then they dig all of these holes around it that actually infiltrate the water away from their entrance so that they've always got a clear run to get in and out. And then all of those holes then infiltrate the water into the water table.
And before we go on, that's pretty interesting that you say that, because I know prairie dogs are, you know, tiny little burrowing animals in the United States who are also communal. And there is, it's just interesting to me, there's also a relationship between them and water, because the Indians of North America would say that the prairie dogs brought rain, and a lot of the Europeans thought that was just nonsense, but it ends up it's actually true that, that for somehow they actually do, I mean, there are statistical studies on this for what that's worth, that they actually do bring rain. So it's very interesting that two burrowing animals across the world affect, I guess maybe it's not so strange, but it is kind of interesting.
Yes, very, very. I didn't know that.
So I want to talk in a moment about why they have burrows, but before we go there, how are wombats doing in general?
They're doing really badly, to be honest. There's so many different things that are going on with them. The northern hairy-nosed wombat is the most critically endangered large mammal in the world. I think the last count was around 300. They got down to 36 animals. and there's none in captivity, so they're trying to save an animal that they literally know nothing about behaviourally. The bare-nosed wombats, they're also known as common wombats, but, you know, the name is obviously starting to change because it's, we've got to change people's perception about that. And their numbers are diminishing so rapidly just from psychotic mange, which is a disease, it's a mite that they get, and we firmly believe it only affects stressed animals because we do see completely healthy animals and completely disease-ridden animals living together in the same warren, and one is not affected and the other one is. And then the southern hairy nose, which is the animals that we really specialise in, we've seen a 70% decline in the last 10 years, and I've seen more than that. You know, that's just as a whole, but the areas that we go, I see 600-700 wombats in an afternoon. 5 years ago, it was only 5 years ago, and now we're lucky to see two or three. The population has just completely, totally and utterly dropped due to poor land management and culling.
So even though the population's gone down by 70%, they're still being intentionally killed.
Yes, the amount of permits issued, destruction permits issued to kill these animals has gone up 509%. Because what's happened is that where they live, it's just not viable for farming. You know, some years they will get as low as 30 mils of rain a year, so it's extremely dry. And so people have gone in, tried to farm it, and then abandoned the land. But what they've done is they've killed out the seed bank. So there's no food for them, so all they're living off is toxic weed. So they've either got the option that they stay there and they die, or they move. And so a lot of animals, the older animals have stayed there, but a lot of the younger animals have moved next door, literally, to their population. And the government's gone and got a $2.1 million grant to enhance that environment. And all of that environment is farmland. So the wombats are moving onto farmland. The government's enriching that area. It's encouraging more wombats to move in there. And, of course, the farmers are killing the wombats subsequently.
So the wombats, just to be clear, the wombats are being encouraged to move in to a place where they then get killed.
Yes.
That sounds brilliant.
Yes. There's a lot of no logic with wombats.
Well, I mean, frankly, there's a lot of no logic. In the United States, we had a vice president a few years ago who said that fish don't actually need water. So, I mean, this is what we run into, you know? So,
yeah.
So let's back up again. And, what do wombats eat?
They mainly eat native grasses.
And so do farmers hate them because the farmers argue that the wombats are competing with sheep for grass? Or what's their excuse?
Yes. There's a couple. They say they damage fences. However, we've set up cameras on properties that have applied for destruction permits due to damage to fences. And every single property, they'd move sheep into paddocks with no water, and it was the sheep going through the fences. And then they say that they cause erosion from their warrens, which, of course, are a natural part of the environment, and farming is far worse. And the other one, that their machinery falls down the warrens. So they're the grounds that they get destruction permits to kill them.
So I'm just curious about this, that in the United States, they like to argue that prey dogs should be killed because cows and horses break their legs in the holes, which is completely untrue. That's simply untrue.
Yes.
And
yes.
So just out of curiosity, is there a single incident of a tractor falling into a warren and getting destroyed that you know of?
Not that I know of, no.
Well.
And also there's definitely no broken legs or animals. In fact, we've got footage of animals taking shelter in their warrens from the extreme heat.
Okay, we need to back up a little bit, because what sort of animals, how big are these holes? Because you say warrens, like what sort of animals are taking shelter in there?
Mainly sheep.
So it's big enough for a sheep to get in?
Yes, some of them, the really old warrens, and we're talking thousands of years old, you can walk in or even drive your car into the entrance. But they're disappearing pretty rapidly now, so they can get absolutely massive. But they have to be really, really old.
So, sorry to jump around so much. I just think this is so interesting.
You're doing great.
I just keep thinking of, so how widely distributed were wombats prior to European conquest? Were they everywhere? Were they just in parts of it?
No, I mean, obviously, all three species have got different distribution, but for the southern hairy-nosed wombat, they basically covered most of South Australia, you know, from about halfway down, but all the way across and into Western Australia and into New South Wales. Now there's 5 populations left.
And what about the northern hairy-nosed wombats who only, how many populations are is that couple hundred wombats?
Well, they were in one population. In the 80s, there was another population that was ignored and killed out by farmers. And then all of a sudden, you know, it was catastrophe when they realised there was only one population left of the species. And so what they've done is they've split the species up. They've split this group up into 2 different areas because they were concerned that if a fire or something came through, that they would wipe out a species. But that relocation was extremely unsuccessful. And so I think they're looking at doing that again, but I don't like the chances.
And were the northern hairy-nosed wombats fairly well distributed prior to conquest too?
Yes, they were. They were. They had a lot. They had quite a big distribution before European settlement.
You've mentioned the threat of direct killing by farmers, and you mentioned the mange, but can you talk just a little bit more about, is that an introduced mange, or was that always there and has just become epidemic?
Well, I mean, we do things very differently, and what we're seeing is completely different compared to research. So it is believed that it was introduced by the European red fox. However, we have, I don't think that at all. I think it's actually a natural part in their environment, and they succumb to that when they're stressed. And I'm saying that is because in our sanctuaries, the mite survives without a host for 21 days in a warren. And so in our sanctuary, we have gone for 3 or 4 years with no mange, and then we'll have a wombat that's been surrendered to us, that's been a pet. And when they start to make that full transition, which is always their choice, to live in warrens, they obviously get stressed. And as much as they can come inside and do whatever they like, they get that stress and they always succumb to mange. So we treat them. And then we bring wombats in that are completely, totally, lovely covered in mange. And our animals that are not stressed, they don't get that at all. So I think it's actually a natural part of the environment because there is no way for the mange or the mites to get into the sanctuary without any host.
Right. So what other threats are there to them besides the direct killing and mange? You mentioned pets. Is capture for pet trade a problem?
Yes, it is. A lot of animals get orphaned mainly. Wombats are hunted for food here in South Australia. And then the babies, the joeys, are given to the kids generally as in the communities as tools of trade. So quite often they'll take them to a local roadhouse and trade them with tourists for money or alcohol. And the wombats are tortured until the people actually pass over money. And then quite often they end up in the wrong hands. And they're raised, they're so gentle and loving and kind until they start to get older and they want to go outside, and then they become extremely destructive. And that's when we end up getting animals surrendered to us. And there's also a huge zoo trade, which is something that we don't support as well.
Did you say, I didn't understand the word zoo or fur?
Zoo trade.
Right, okay.
So there's actually a program that takes in orphan wombats to sell them to zoos and demonstrators, and we don't support that.
Right. So let's talk about the mange before we talk about other threats. The obvious solution is to stop stressing the wombats. There other solutions that are being proposed for the mange if it is being a significant killer of a species in 70% decline?
Yes. For starters, there are key indicator to the environment. So obviously, in the environment is ideal, but that's a very large scale thing. We tried in 2010, we set up a mange eradication program. So we used self-treatment slaps, and that actually helped the wombat in the wild without us having to bring them in. And that was quite successful, only it was quite hit and miss. And so that's now being undertaken in other states, you know, far larger than what we did. And we don't do that anymore. As soon as the wombat's got mange, we catch the wombat, we bring them in, and we treat them, and then we can release them back into the wild. Because in 3 days, they are completely different animals. And I've just put a video up, actually, on our Facebook page to show the change, which is so quickly, but generally people euthanize them. And it stops the whole learning process. So what we're trying to do is that we can help these animals, but the environment needs to be looked at. I'll just treating for 3 years in a row, we treated animals to the point that there was no more mange. And then I got a phone call from one of the local residents and said that all the wombats are, the burrows are gone. And so I went out there, and the farmer, these animals were on public land. The farmer had pushed through the fence with his tractor, destroying his fence. He had filled the warrens up with phostoxin, which is a gas that's illegal to use on wombats. Then he'd filled the holes with boulders so that the wombats could not get out. And then he completely covered them all with dirt so that they could not dig out. And he was let off saying that he thought about rabbit warrens, and despite the size of the burrows. But what we found out later is that every year he was poisoning these animals, and it wasn't enough to kill them, but it was enough to stress them, and that was what was actually causing the mange. So there's, you know, so many problems for these animals in regards to what actually causes the mange.
So in the United States, I've lived in the Western United States, in rural Western United States, for pretty much my whole life, and there is an overwhelming hatred of wolves among especially ranchers. And I grew up in the plains, there is an overwhelming hatred by farmers and ranchers of prairie dogs, and both of those are completely non-rational. And I didn't know this before we started talking, but it's sounding to me like there is a completely non-rational hatred, I guess what some people would call excess repression, a hatred of wombats that goes beyond simple economics of them being annoyed because they're supposedly eating their grass or something.
Yes.
Can you talk about that hatred for a minute?
I can. We actually started getting friends with some farmers, and they're very intelligent people. And they gave us a really good insight, because they said that the wombats aren't the problem. They're a symptom of the problem. So we have a very high suicide rate within the farmers within this region. And it's mainly due to trying to farm in an area that is really not viable. And if they can't control the weather, they try to control everything on their property. And it is an old mindset that wombats are going to take over. And in actual fact, we've found that the people that do cull have the greatest problems with wombats and population boom. And we've learned in our sanctuary, because we were trying to work out a way of how we were going to manage the breeding in our sanctuary, because at this stage we really don't want to breed them, because there are so many animals in trouble that we keep on coming to us. And we've got two dominant females. They're both blind. They both come from the wild. And they were just so awful with trying to introduce new wombats. Just really aggressive. They would not accept them. And it just made it really hard for us to keep on taking in all of these adult wombats. So our dominant female, we decided to build her a separate area by herself. And so we removed her and we popped her in there by herself. And after 14 days, there was absolute indiscriminate mating. They were mating on the veranda, on the driveway. Everywhere you looked, there was wombats mating. And thankfully, when I worked in the zoo, and I saw this happening with kangaroos when we removed the dominant male, and so we put her back in and there was normal social order. So what we work out with this, and this is how we manage our population now, we have 46 wombats in care at the moment, is that she's the dominant female, is always the first to eat. So she comes up and comes inside at night and she'll eat, and she goes off when she comes into season. We don't see her, so that's when we know to separate her. So she gets separated for 10 days, which is her season. If we leave her for more than 14 days, hell breaks loose, but if we put her back in within that period of time, that's how we regulate the population. And now it takes us at least 12 to 18 months to introduce a new adult wombat. So when you relay that in the wild, if they're destroying the dominant female, she's the one that's keeping all of the new wombats from entering into the population. She's also controlling all of the breeding, and she's absolutely vital in the management of these animals. And that is why we have seen so many properties that don't cull have stable populations for 50 years, 100 years, and the people that do cull are whinging and complaining about the uncontrollable population boom.
That sounds very similar to both mountain lions, well, not similar, but analogous to mountain lions and coyotes, both of whom go, it's counterintuitive that if you start killing them off, you actually end up with more of them. It's a very strange thing. So let's talk about reproduction in general and talk about social structures. Let's just talk basics first, like who has babies and how many and how often?
Okay, well, the southern hairy-nosed wombats, they need 3 good consecutive years of rainfall before they'll have a baby, a joey, and they'll have 1 joey every 3 years. So in their whole lifetime, they're lucky to have 2 or 3 joeys, and there's a 10% survival rate of those babies to reach adulthood. But they're very slow breeders. The bare-nosed wombats, they have 1 generally every 2 years, and they don't have that big, strong social structure, and the joeys also don't seem to stay with them as long as what the southern hairy-nosed wombats do.
So with the southern hairy-nosed, how long do they live?
14 in the wild, 35 in captivity.
Okay, so if they have a baby only after 3 good years of rain, and they will have, I'm sorry, how many per pregnancy?
Just one. Just one. Yeah.
And then how, let's say that it's really good rain for many years in a row, how long after they have a baby do they have another one? You said 3 years.
Usually
again?
Two to three years, yes, depending on when the little girl will leave. Generally, if it's a little girl, she'll stay around a lot longer, 2 to 3 years, or become part of their family. And that's what actually delays the breeding process.
So
they will not breed again until that baby's left.
And is it typical in wild warrens for the matriarch or the mother of them all to sort of control breeding in that way so that the other females also don't breed? Is the entire colony reproducing very, very, very slowly?
Well, we don't know. We don't know. We can only, they are so secretive, no one knows anything about these animals. And that's why, because we essentially have a sanctuary, all of the ones that are trying to mate and breeding and, they've all come from the wild. They've all come from the wild as adults, and they all live as wild animals. We only put food out for them so that we can see them, because otherwise we simply don't see them. They are that secretive. And so this is how we've got to understand what's actually happening. We can only relay that to the wild, but I don't feel that there's any way that anyone could possibly be able to work this out in the wild.
So,
we had a film crew come. Sorry.
No, go ahead, please.
We had a film crew come across from Germany wanting to film the wombats, and they tried for 6 months, and they set up cameras 300 metres from their warrens, and in 4 days all the wombats moved. So they just had no luck, and that's when they did the documentary within the sanctuary.
So in the wild, you've used the word secretive. It sounds also, are they also timid, or is this because they've been shot so much that they're just smart and they leave?
I think it's a combination of both. We can't drive a diesel car in their habitat at all, because you will not see any. So we have to drive petrol cars. but they are extremely timid animals. And it's hard to leave because they've got such bold personalities, but when it comes to people, I think it's probably just ingrained in them to run and hide because they have been shot so much.
And it sounds to me like with a creature who reproduces so slowly that pre-conquest, they must not have had... Who were their enemies? Why would a wombat die once it became an adult 500 years ago?
Well, it was only wedge-tailed eagles. They were their only threat. And aside from being hunted for food, but that was, you know, quite insignificant. So that was it.
Once they reached adulthood, they probably had decent... They had low rates of mortality then, because there can't be that many eagles.
Yes. No, it was purely climatic changes, and that's what we've seen throughout European history of what's actually happened to the animal. It's just been drought, and that is what controls the population.
So before we talk about that, let's talk about that and then talk about their intelligence and personality later. Tell me more about you've mentioned mange, direct shooting, and pet trade, zoo trade, and hunting for food. I don't remember if I already mentioned that. So what are the threats? You just mentioned climate.
Climate is probably underneath the human destruction. That would be, you know, pretty high up there. I think that in 1990 we had a huge drought, and I think it saw 90% of certain populations killed. So that is, you know, nature has its ways, and I guess. And so we haven't seen that since, but I have seen a huge decline due to poor land management.
And what do you mean by poor land management?
It's just where the farmers have tried to farm land that is not suitable for farming, and then they've destroyed the seed bank and left the... And I'm talking a huge amount of land. I'm talking at least 1 million acres that have been destroyed, which is the prime habitat for wombats. And when I say it's bad, it is really bad. I just walk up and pick up wombats that are just lying on their side eating dirt because that's all that they've got to eat. It is, it's been catastrophic for this population.
And how are wombats doing who are fairly far away from any farming lands? Are there populations that you know of? Obviously very secretive, it's very hard to tell. But are those populations also suffering, or are they doing okay?
I don't know of any that are not in trouble at all, and I don't know any that aren't on farming land. Even the conservation park has had all of the weeds and the crops blow onto their properties, and they cannot keep up with it. There's a weed called onionweed that we have down here, and it has just taken their habitat by storm, and it's toxic, and they've got nothing else to eat, and that's all throughout the conservation park now, and the managers cannot keep up with it. They have hundreds of people onto it, and they still can't keep up with it. And the population is just going, even on the conservation park.
Wow, this is just dreadful. So what other threats, I mean, as if that isn't enough, are there other threats to them?
No, aside from... there's the culling, the legal culling, and then there's the illegal culling. So there's a lot of people that go up and shoot them for fun. And it's really sad because quite often if you've got a petrol car, the wombats will walk up to the car and, you know, just sniff around the car and walk off, and people shoot them. And so we've got a lot of wombats that have been shot, and we've just found them, you know, dying on the side of the road. So that's another issue that they have. But I think, you know, the climatic changes and the culling are the biggest ones for them. They really are. There is no way are these animals going to last, you know, a long period of time. I think, you know, I give them 20 years and they'll be in the same position as the northern hairy-nosed wombat.
Well, thank you for starting your work before they get to the northern hairy-nosed wombat territory, because I think it's, as soon as you start to see a decline from a still significant population, that's when we really need to put in the effort.
Yes, absolutely.
So tell me more about their personalities and intelligence and just what they're like.
They are just the most... They are the most amazing animals. They are full of self-love for themselves. They're full of their own confidence. They are really clear in their communication of what they want. They don't like being told what to do. And yet they live in this big social family group where they cuddle each other and they look after each other. And I was speaking to a doctor the other week who said the more, because there is a huge difference in intellect between the bare-nosed wombat and the hairy-nosed wombat. And he said the more social the animals are, the higher their intelligence is. And so I never actually knew that beforehand. But with these babies, they suck their thumb when they're sad, they smile when they're happy, they understand words, they've got just such a playful, full of life personality. And also, you know, they come in, the thing that amazes me the most is that we rescue these animals and they weigh 20% of their body weight. People thought that we were mad trying to save these animals because the largest adult we've had and her body measurement, she should have been 30, 31 kilos and she came in at 6.3 kilos. Skin and bone. And yet they recover and they respond to care so well. And she was in care for 2 years before she got back up on her feet and got her confidence about going outside. We just never see her again. She lives within the sanctuary, but she's just returned back to that wild state because her instinct is so strong. And so it's just for me, they have so many human traits that I think really are starting to get people interested in them and people are starting to be able to relate to them as well as them being completely, totally, and utterly gorgeous.
And let's say you have that one warren you said, I'm sorry, it covered 500 acres?
Yes.
Okay. So how far would wombats go beyond that 500 acres to eat? Do they go another mile? Do they go another 100 yards?
Well, their range is only about 5 acres, and it just depends on the food source. So when we released our wombats at our last sanctuary, they could come and go, do whatever they want. But they didn't go further than 150 metres from their warren. Their warren is their home. It's everything to them. So they purely only go out to eat, and that's it. Their whole social life, everything is underground.
And do they poop inside, or they go outside to poop too?
In the sanctuary inside at our place?
No, in the warrens.
In the burrow. Well, I see them digging out bits of poo, but most of the time they'll go out and poo under a tree.
And they must, how do they dig? They must have incredibly strong legs to dig these huge long warrens.
They are amazing. Their legs are about 15 centimetres long, and they're about that round. And they dig, and then they've got a hard cartilage pallet in their bottom. So they dig with their front legs, and then they use their bum like a shovel and actually push the dirt out that way. But in saying that, they're not prolific diggers. They dig their warrens, but you only see a bit of a clean out once or twice a year because they conserve their energy as much as possible.
And it's stunning to me that, I mean, delightful, this is wonderful, that they have communities that I don't want to put words in your mouth, but it sounded like you were saying that huge warren was there for hundreds of years, for...
Oh, thousands. It is so, some of their warrens are so old, and there's pictures, Aboriginal drawings of them on a local cave. You know, they're very, very, very old warrens.
And that breaks my heart even more to see some of those bulldozed or, you know, otherwise destroyed.
Yes, but there was this beautiful population, and it had the biggest burrows I have ever seen in my life. We could walk in them for about 30 metres, and they were just perched on the side of a hill. It was Crown land. Nobody used this land, and I used to go there every 6 months to go and check on them. And I went I went there, and the whole lot of warrens was collapsed. So anatomically, wombats can dig up, but they simply can't. So the amount of sand that they put on those warrens, those babies would have been trapped and buried alive. And there was no need for it at all, because they were not bothering anyone. The land was not suitable or used for anything. It was on the side of a hill, and it was only a small patch of land. And I don't understand that, because that is so much history, let alone the lives that have been lost within that small community there.
Yeah. Yeah, that's... We the whole world has gotten outraged that that ISIS, for example, has been destroying museums and pieces of art around the world. But I say, shoot, you know, this is the same thing. This is destroying these ancient communities.
Yes, that's really beautifully said. Yes.
Oh, thanks. So, tell me more about the sanctuary. How did it start? And then walk me through the process that somebody from hearing about a wombat to the final time you ever see it.
Okay. So I used to work in zoos. I've spent most of my adult life working in zoos, and I always looked after wombats in zoos. And then when I had to look after an orphan one. An orphan baby, and they breed in captivity. They never breed in captivity, but this pair breed. And I found her at 4 o'clock in the morning, scraping the jelly out of the pouch. And I sat with her for hours, and she didn't want that baby anymore because she was hand-raised. She didn't know what she was doing. And so I took that baby, and within 3 hours, my life changed. This baby didn't even have his eyes open, but there was something magic about them. It's like everything in my life came together. And the more I looked after him, the more I realized what an injustice it was of how these animals are kept in captivity. And I was so distraught at the concept of him going back into that life that was it. It took me no time at all to get the properties on the market, to leave the family and friends. And I ended up buying a block off the internet because I was that all my logic went out the window. And I bought this awful property off the internet, but it got me down to South Australia, and it got him out of any chance of having to be going back into captivity. And from my work in zoos, and I thought they always had to be kept separate, and so I built, you know, separate enclosures for them, and that lasted less than a few months because there were so many animals that needed help, and it wasn't really my intention to start rescuing to the extent of what I did. But they came in hard and fast, and they showed me pretty quickly that they live communally. They don't want to be kept separate. And they would just peel tin off, you know, steel posts to get in together. And so it was a very gradual process. Because the block that we bought, they couldn't dig burrows on because the limestone shelf was so thick. So we moved to another area and we got another sanctuary for them. And that's when we really became free range and we really understood the concept, of how, what it does to them to put them into cages and how that destroys their trust and destroys their will to live. So we don't ever put them in cages. And that's when we started having to look at how we're going to manage the population. And so they have been the biggest teachers for us. And the way that they come in is so varied. Quite often we will be driving along, we'll see a dying wombat, we'll jump out of the car and catch it as it's running down their burrow. And then we make the assessment as to whether or not that animal can be returned to the wild. So we have a look at so many different key factors. Is the habitat viable? Why did they come into care? Were they shot? Were they starving to death? Did they have mange? What are the likelihood of them coming back into the wild and ending up in the same situation? And the thing that I have with these animals is that I don't just love the one, it is the whole species. I feel just as passionately about a wombat that I have not met as what I do about one that I've hand-raised. And it's something that I can't change, and I've tried really hard to change it, and it doesn't work. So that's why we've built this big sanctuary now, and how we work with the animals to try and assimilate them into the community, and we support them all the way through the community, and literally until they die, they don't go anywhere else if we make that decision that they're going to live with us. and we just go through every effort that we can to try and help an animal that, you know, help an animal that needs the help, and whether or not it's to be released back into the wild or whether or not it's to come into captivity or come into the sanctuary, then we support them through that individually.
And let's say that one is going to be released back in the wild. That would be back to where, like,
they came
would
from.
That, and that would be like you see one that's hit by a car, you bring it in until its leg heals, and then and then you put it back out.
Yes, by law, we've only got 4 weeks. 4 weeks before we can release them, and that's because they lose their territory. Once they've lost their territory, and their whole social structure is changed within their family group, they don't get accepted back in. So what happens is that animal gets pushed out from territory to territory to territory until it runs itself to death. It's also exposed to extreme climatic conditions, which they're not designed for. They're designed for cool temperatures. And so, you know, we have had other people that have released these animals and literally watched them run themselves to death. So that's why we're really careful about what happens, and we always have to release them back to where they've come from, as long as they've got that 4 week period. Now, if we wanted to do soft release, what we would have to do, and that would be extremely successful, but it's really complicated because the animals have to come back by law. They have to go back to where they came from. So what we would have to do is, we know it takes them 12 months to establish a territory. So we would have to build them a soft release enclosure with temperature-controlled environment, unless there's an empty warren there. Then those animals would have to be fed every day for 12 months, and then eventually after the 12 months, we could start opening up the fence to let them still have their warren, but to come and go and eventually assimilate into the wild population. So it's their social structure that actually stops us from being able to release them.
So how would, insofar as we know, how would... let's pretend it's 1,000 years ago or something. How would the young adults? How would they make a new warren? How does that? Who leaves and what happens
still
to them?
Mm-hmm. Well, the females generally stay within that family group. The little boys, the juvenile boys, from when they're really small, usually about 4 kilograms. They're out starting to dig their new warren. And so then they eventually take that over. A lot of the young males are kicked out of their territory and have to move on. And that's when I get a lot of reports of people seeing, you know, young males. Well, a lot of farmers just shoot them as they see them walking around looking for a new burrow. So that the males have a pretty low survival rate in the wild, and that's, you know, essentially how it always has been.
And how, obviously a male can't make a new warren by himself, so how do the females end up leaving the old warren ever?
Well, I don't think the females leave the warren at all. And the babies, the juvenile boys, they start digging the new warren. The adults do not create new warrens at all. That is the baby's job, the baby boy's job, and that's what we've seen also, which affects with the culling, is when they've got the population increase, and then they've got the new joeys, and the new boys, and then the boys go out and start digging new warrens. And then it all goes downhill from there. Is that what you're trying to get at? Is that the females generally don't make their own warrens. We find that it's the juvenile males that dig the new warrens.
So when he makes a new warren, obviously, it's some, for there to be more wombats, at some point a female has to show up. So does he basically prepare it, and then how does it happen that leaves the old one?
It's still within a neighbouring community. So obviously they all live communally, but their warren is their home and their territory. So this baby will probably, I've seen them sometimes only 10 metres away from the warren. He'll start digging his own new burrow. And then obviously he'll meet a girl, or as he moves up in the ranks, he'll start pushing the older males out. The older males go into these the other small warrens that have already been created. And you'll see in extreme temperatures, the dominant, the healthy, they all go into these, we call them nuclear warrens, the large warrens, and then all of the old and the young get pushed out into these little tiny burrows that surround the nuclear warrens. And so that's what happens, is they move their way up through the social system.
So really what I'm getting at is wombats expand their territory at a glacial rate.
Yes.
Because like salmon, you know, salmon all come back the same stream, except it ends up that only 95% or 97% or something like that actually go back to the stream. And actually 5% of the salmon are really inquisitive, and they can go somewhere completely different. So they can actually... they can expand their range very, very, very quickly.
Wow.
Yeah, so it sounds like, on the other hand, this is yet another concern for me, because... it sounds like for them to recover will take, because of slow reproductive rate and slow rate of expansion of territory, it will take, even if every other risk factor was taken away, it would take, making a number up, 1,000 years for them to get back to what they were.
Yes, yes, yeah.
Oh.
There's biologically, there's only 110 years difference between... the two extents of the population. So the Nullarbor population, the furthest population away, is the Murray Lands. So in 110 years, they have been completely, totally, utterly fragmented to a point that there is, you know, there's no chance for them to come back from that.
Right. I want to mention one more thing before we start to wind down, which is it's very interesting to me that the young males are the ones who build the new warrens and have a high rate of mortality, because it makes me think of honeybees. And honeybees have different roles during their lives. When they're young, they're nurse bees. They nurse other bees. And then they become guards. And then after that, they become foragers. And then after that, they become scouts. And the point is, every one of those jobs is more dangerous than the one before. And also, they have less life left. So it's actually a... it would be a complete waste of energy to take the young bees to put them on a dangerous job, because they still have 30 days of flying left that they can do. And from a wombat perspective, it's so interesting to me that the young males are the least important reproductively, and also then that the wombat community over the millennia has chosen them to do the most dangerous job.
Yes. Yes.
That's pretty fascinating.
Very.
So we have about 5 minutes left, and a couple questions. The first one is, so things are obviously pretty grim, and if they made you tomorrow the queen of all things wombat, and... and you could put in place any policies you want, except you can't get rid of capitalism or civilization on the first week. You can do that in week two or something. The point is you can't get rid of the whole system right now, which you and I both know is pretty destructive. But leave that aside. What policies would you implement to help them, given the constraints of the current system?
I would obviously can the culling. That would be the first thing, because there's just so many animals being killed that it's just so unnecessary. And I would implement a system I want to introduce a wombat accreditation. So if all the companies knew that were buying the products from these farmers, knew what was actually happening to these animals and knew how cruel the culling was, and I haven't even touched the illegal culling to the extent of what they actually do to these animals, then the only way we could stop it, even if the government banned culling tomorrow, the farmers would still do it, because there's really isolated areas. So the only way we can actually stop this is to hit them in the hip pocket to say, okay, if you want to still have someone to buy these products, you need to stop culling wombats. In order to do that, you need to be accredited. So your property gets evaluated each year that you are still doing the right thing by these animals. And I think that would be the biggest move towards them. And then, of course, it would be, obviously, revegetation of their habitat. And I think those two things alone would make such a significant difference to these animals and would stop the rapid decrease very, very quickly.
So... tell me what's your website, and also tell me how... I'm going to have one more question after this. Tell me your website, and tell me how people can directly support your work. And my final question is going to be, how can they support wombats in general? So first, like, your website and the name of your sanctuary.
Mm-hmm. Okay, our website is www.wombatawareness.com. You can follow us on Facebook, which is Wombat Awareness Organisation. And the best way that they can help is by getting on board on our Facebook and to be able to share things, because knowledge is power, and the more support these animals have, the better they're going to come across, because, you know, to date there's been no one standing up for them. We're the first people that have come in and said, look, this is really wrong and we're not going anywhere and we're going to change things. So that's where we really need people's support.
Well, thank you. Is there anything you want to say either about wombats or about your work that I haven't given you opportunity?
I don't think so. I think you've been really generous with your coverage. We are trying to secure a sanctuary for the wombats, because eventually we would like to increase it where they have a huge wild protected area, because our services are pretty high for demand at the moment, and it's not going backwards. It's actually getting more and more and more. And so we're trying to secure our very first sanctuary. We've only been leasing properties, and we've found our dream property. And so we're really going to be pushing that soon, because we're not looking for people to donate. We're looking for people to contribute, to give us a loan to actually step into this property, which is pretty amazing and really vital for these animals, because, to be honest, we're really at capacity inside at the moment, and so in that way we do need a lot of help.
I guess, and I hope people help. And I guess I do have one more question, which is, how, if someone wanted to replicate your work, either to help wombats or to help any other creature, what? I'm going to back up one second and say, you're one of my heroes, because the distinction is between, the big distinction is not between those who believe we need to bring everything down and those who believe in working within the system. None of that. The big distinction is between those who do nothing and those who do something. And
yes.
I love the fact that you saw a problem, and instead of just complaining to all your friends about, wow, this is a terrible problem, you got off your butt and did something. So,
Thank you. Yes. So
what, if somebody either wants to help wombats or wants to help giant salamanders, I mean, it doesn't matter.
What
advice would you give them to really help get them, spur them to action?
I think that the relationship with yourself is more important than anything. So if you have a good relationship with yourself, you've got the courage to stand up and do something that you really want to do. And I have so many people go, oh, I really wanted to do this, but then this happened. And it's, rather than taking on the challenge to go, this happened, but I found a way through it. And that's what helps you grow as a person and makes you be more determined and helps you actually live. Because a lot of people don't live, they just exist. And then doing something that you really want to do makes you come alive and brings fire and love and everything that everyone looks for into their life. So I would say to people that if there's something that you really want to do and you've got a really good relationship with yourself, then everything will fall into place perfectly. And don't let the bumps in the road stop you from following what you really want to do.
Well, thank you so much. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Bridget Stevens. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.